You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This episode of American Innovations contains some sexual content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. It's October 26, 1916, a cold, damp day in Brownsville, Brooklyn. A young nurse named Margaret Sanger hurries along the sidewalk. She keeps her head down as she walks and pulls her hat down tight around her fiery red hair. It's best not to call attention to herself. Brownsville is a working-class neighborhood, one of the most remote and poorest sections of the city. The people who live here are mostly immigrants, mainly Russian and German Jews. But recently, Italians have arrived too. Almost no one speaks English. Large families are packed into dark, gloomy tenement buildings. The adults work long hours for little pay in the nearby factories. The children play on unpaved streets, which are filled with raw sewage and garbage. As Sanger approaches her destination, she can already see the cluster of empty baby carriages parked outside the nondescript storefront. It has no sign, no indication of what goes on inside. Just an address, 46 Amboy Street. Still, it's attracted a crowd. A group of women sit on a wrought iron bench, waiting for their turn to enter. Sanger passes the line and enters the clinic, suspecting another long day is ahead of her. Inside, her suspicions are confirmed. The waiting room is packed to the gills with women. This is the Sanger Birth Control Clinic, a family planning center dedicated to educating women about reproductive options. It's the first of its kind in the United States. It's also completely illegal. Sanger has just started removing her coat when a young woman approaches.
Oy weis mir, helf mich.
Where's the Yiddish translator? One of the many volunteers joins them. The two women talk in Yiddish. She says she has six children. Her husband was hurt at the factory and can't work. Now she's pregnant again. She says she's here for the secret. Sanger's heart sinks, but she doesn't show her emotions. Tell her I'm sorry, but we can't do anything right now except get her through her pregnancy. The women speak again, more Yiddish. Oh God, she said she can't afford to have the baby. She says she's going to swallow glass. Sadly, it's not the first time Sanger's heard a threat like this, and she knows it's far from idle. Tell her that her family needs her, and after she has the baby, we'll help her with birth control. The mother bursts into tears. Sanger comforts her as best as she can, but this is all she can offer. As hard as it is, she has to move on. There are at least 50 other women waiting to see her, women she can help now, before they get pregnant. Things are just beginning to settle in when the clinic doors are thrown open. As men in uniform swarm the space, a wave of panic spreads across the room.
Everybody stay where you are. We're from the Vice Squad. Mrs. Sanger, you are under arrest.
The police cart Sanger away and close the doors of the Amboy Street Clinic. It would never reopen again. When the police raided the Sanger Birth Control Clinic in 1916, they confiscated condoms, cervical caps, and instructional pamphlets. At the time, they were the only means of birth control for women. None of them were particularly effective, and all were illegal. Sanger was convicted of illegally distributing contraceptives. She served 30 days in the rat and roach-infested Queens County Penitentiary for her crime. But Sanger had much bigger plans. She would spend the next four decades of her life trying to develop a simple pill that would give women the reproductive freedom they were literally dying for.
We'll be right back. wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Wondery, this is American Innovations, and I'm Stephen Johnson. When Margaret Sanger opened the doors to her birth control clinic in 1916, she knew she was breaking the law, but she didn't care. Sanger was a nurse by trade, and as such, she'd sworn to devote herself to the welfare of those in her care. And in the early 1900s, that meant doing something about the public health crisis caused by unplanned pregnancies. At the turn of the century, many women were having babies with no break in between pregnancies. It put them at risk for anemia and uterine ruptures. Miscarriages were common. Of the children that were born, one in five died during the first 5 years of life. Poor families were adversely affected because without family planning, they often could not afford to feed all of their children. Thousands died of disease and malnutrition. By the 1920s, one-third of all pregnancies ended in abortions. Many women were so desperate to end their pregnancies, they tried horrifying techniques like drinking household poisons or using metal coat hangers. It resulted in countless deaths. Sanger was horrified by all the suffering caused by unwanted pregnancies, so she made it her mission to provide safe options for family planning. She wrote and spoke about birth control, opened clinics, and even started a worldwide organization to educate women. But for Sanger, it was like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. Nothing she could do changed the fact that women still had little control and few choices. She desperately wanted to change that. To Sanger, the solution was clear: a safe, effective, discreet contraceptive for women, in the form of a pill no bigger than an aspirin. At the time, the idea seemed more radical than putting a man on the moon. In some ways, developing it would be even more difficult. This is the story of four people: an activist, a philanthropist, a biologist, and a gynecologist, who would come together to make Sanger's impossible dream a reality. They would work against tremendous odds and risk everything to develop a safe and effective oral contraceptive. Their work would save lives and spark a worldwide revolution in science, healthcare, religion, and public policy. But it all began with a single meeting in a Park Avenue apartment and a question. This is episode one. But can it be done? It's December 1950. The Upper East Side of New York City. Park Avenue is tastefully decorated with Christmas lights, giant cutout snowflakes, and bright red bows, all the trappings of the holidays. In the light snowfall, people walk and laugh, bundled in long winter coats, over suits and party dresses, carrying foil-wrapped bottles of booze. An elderly woman hurries past the revelers, wearing sturdy, thick-soled shoes and a sensible wool coat. When she reaches her destination, she quickly hurries out of the cold and curtly gives her name to the doorman. Margaret Sanger. He ushers her to the elevator and the doors close. They ride up in silence as typical holiday songs play over the speaker. The doorman wishes her a Merry Christmas. Sanger almost smiles. She knows exactly what she wants from Santa Claus. It's been more than 30 years since Sanger got arrested for illegal distribution of birth control products. She is 71 years old now, and her red hair has long since gone gray. But her focus has remained steadily fixed on her goal. Through protests, speeches, writing, and sheer willpower, she's turned her personal mission into a national movement. One by one, the movement has been slowly knocking down barriers that prevented women from having access to contraceptives. The term birth control, which Sanger herself helped popularize, was now widely used. It was no longer regarded as taboo subject matter like it had been in 1916. Attitudes about women and their place in society had changed, and she had played a big role in bringing that about. But there was one lifelong goal she had been unable to achieve. It had become her personal holy grail, the only thing she ever really wanted, an oral contraceptive for women. Tonight, she'll finally meet the man capable of creating such a pill. All she has to do is recruit him to her cause. The doors open on an elegant high-rise apartment where an extravagant party is in the works. The host, Sanger's longtime friend and colleague, is waiting to greet her.
Oh, my dear, it's excellent to see you. Let's get you out of your coat. I've arranged for your favorite bubbly, Moet.
Is he here yet?
You haven't changed a bit. Still as impatient as ever. No, alas, not yet. But you know the drive from Boston is perilous on days when there's snow. He'll be here.
Are you sure he's coming? Are you absolutely sure?
If I know Goody, he wouldn't miss this for anything. Just be patient.
Sanger sighs. She's been waiting her whole life for this meeting. What's another hour or two? She accepts her glass of champagne and takes a long sip, then watches the snow fall outside the huge window overlooking Manhattan. It feels like she's been on the same road, fighting the same fight forever. In moments like these, it can be hard to remember all the details of the journey that led her here, but she never forgets how it began. Sanger was one of 11 children. By the time she was a teenager, she'd watched her mother Anne suffer through 18 pregnancies, 7 of which ended in miscarriages. Anne was constantly ill. Each pregnancy left her weaker, less able to fight off sickness, let alone tend to her children. In 1899, when Anne died of tuberculosis at the age of 50, Sanger enrolled in nursing school and committed herself to helping women like her mother. At the time, she was going against societal convention, which expected girls to return home when their mother died to take over the household chores. But with the help of her older sisters, Sanger avoided that fate. It wasn't the last time she would break society's rules. After nursing school, she took a job as a home visiting nurse for an organization that provided health services to poor women. By 1912, most of her work centered around helping with childbirth. During this time, Sanger came face to face with the horrifying living conditions in the tenement neighborhoods of New York City and Brooklyn. Some women had only newspapers to wrap their newborns in after giving birth. Others were adding a baby to an already huge family of hungry and sick kids. Many women, knowing they couldn't afford to feed another infant, were resorting to self-induced abortions. Those years of working as a childbirth nurse had exposed her to heartbreaking cases she'd never forget. The memory of one woman in particular still shook Margaret to her very core. On one cold October evening in 1912, she had been called to the Lower East Side to help with an emergency. She had already been to the ramshackle building on Grand Street 3 months before with a doctor. Together, they had saved the life of a 28-year-old mother named Sadie Sachs after she'd given herself an abortion. Now, Margaret was back, dreading what she would find. 3 flights up the rickety stairs, a door flung open. Sadie's panicked husband stepped into the hallway and begged her to hurry. Inside the windowless apartment, 3 small, thin children huddled together in a corner. They stared, wide-eyed, at Margaret, but didn't say anything. She could hear a woman moaning in pain and race to the back bedroom. Sadie was lying on a small mattress under dirty blankets. Her face was deathly pale, and now she lay still. When Margaret pulled back the covers, there was blood everywhere.
Oh, Sadie, no. She tried again. Is the baby gone?
Yes.
And my Sadie?
I'm so sorry. Sadie is gone too.
The young husband started sobbing. Sanger was at a loss. Sadie Sachs could have been any woman who lived in New York in 1912. After her last pregnancy and abortion attempt, Sadie's doctor had warned her that another pregnancy might be fatal. Sadie had asked what she could do. He had joked, "Tell your husband to sleep on the roof." Sadie had then turned to Sanger and begged her for the secret to preventing pregnancy. But at the time, Sanger didn't know either. After Sadie died, Sanger knew just one thing. She couldn't go back to barely keeping women alive through one dangerous pregnancy after another. If Sadie's life meant anything, it was to inspire Sanger to help change the lives of other women. To really change them, in a lasting way. Sanger became obsessed with finding something simple that could control women's ovulation cycles. Cervical caps and diaphragms were cumbersome and unreliable, and condoms were too dependent on men's willing participation. She envisioned a more elegant and simple solution. A pill that could be taken in private, that wouldn't need elaborate instructions. Sanger started routinely asking doctors, researchers, and scientists if it was possible to produce such a contraceptive. The response was negative across the board. Even if you could make it work, it was too controversial, and besides that, it was illegal. Among the scientific leaders of the time, and let's be clear, they were all men, the consensus was simply, it couldn't be done. Now, after 30 years and countless no's, Sanger was hoping against hope that tonight, at this Park Avenue party, one doctor would say yes. One glass of Moët later, and someone tells her Dr. Gregory Goodwin Pincus has finally arrived. He finds her, and they lock eyes. It's about damn time. Pincus heads straight for Margaret. She is the reason he has made the 180-mile trip in the snow from his home outside Boston. Sanger takes another gulp of her champagne. Here goes nothing. Dr. Pincus, I'm Margaret Sanger. I know who you are. It's my distinct pleasure. I hope you'll say that after we talk. Shall we sit? The 5'10" scientist with the bushy mustache and permanently ruffled hair points to a couple of wingback chairs near the fireplace. They sit down as he lights a cigarette. Pincus is a certified genius and an expert in mammalian reproduction, but he's also an outcast. He has zero scientific renown, no prizes or patents to his name. He's been booted out of one academic research post and walked away from another. But she's banking on his status as a maverick and an outsider. Because that's just the kind of person who could pull off a controversial project that has never been tried before. He might scoff at it. He might even say no. But at this point, in Margaret's view, neither one of them has much to lose.
Dr. Pincus, I'm going to tell it to you straight. I want you to develop a contraceptive for women. It must be a pill. No messy or hard-to-use gels or injections. And it needs to be affordable, safe, and 100% effective.
Pincus lights another cigarette.
A pill? How intriguing. It would require research and testing, and of course money to fund the project.
Are you saying that it's possible? A pill? A birth control pill?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
The answer takes a minute to sink in. He said, yes, absolutely. Sanger knows she should be skeptical, but she's 71 years old now and not in the best of health. Out of options, and all but out of time. She can't help but feel excited. Pincus takes a drag of his cigarette.
Of course, the biggest issue will be in going against hundreds of years of institutional thinking. There will be incredible pushback. I mean, you know that, yes? Dr. Pincus, I've spent my whole life fighting. I don't give a damn. What about you? If someone tells me no, it just makes me push harder.
Then let's get started right away. With your smoking habit and my age, there's no time to waste.
She raises her glass to his. Thanks to The Art of Shaving for sponsoring American Innovations. If you've been listening to our show for a while, you've probably noticed that life in the past could be pretty rough, hence our constant need for innovation. Shaving is no exception, and The Art of Shaving is here to make sure that you enjoy a close, comfortable shave today and every day. The Art of Shaving's dedication to using high-quality essential oils and botanical ingredients in their award-winning products has now evolved into a collection that will help with all your grooming needs, from head to toe. Now is your chance to see what the four elements of the perfect shave really feel like. Listeners of American Innovations are invited to get 15% off their first order by using the promo code AI at checkout, online, or at any The Art of Shaving stores. Again, that's code AI to get 15% off your first order and start enjoying your shave again. It's December 1950, the morning after the party. Dr. Gregory Pincus parks his car outside a two-story ivy-covered brick house in Worcester, Massachusetts. It may look like a ladies' social club, but this is Pincus's lab, the Worcester Foundation for Experimental Biology. Pincus co-founded the facility in 1946, after more or less getting booted out of the world of academic research. It's one of the first private research foundations in the nation, and a point of civic pride for the community. Worcester is a small, blue-collar factory town about an hour's drive from Boston. Locals like to bring their visiting friends and family, and schoolchildren often tour the grounds with their classes. As Pincus barrels down the walkway towards his laboratory, he passes one such group of kids on a tour. The guide tries to flag Pincus down.
Dr. Pincus, would you like to say a few words to our visiting students? Nope, you're doing great. Kids, keep up your studies.
Pincus speedwalks past the facility's dining room, bedroom, and kitchen, all of which have been converted into laboratories that look like they're straight out of a sci-fi movie. Beakers everywhere with makeshift aluminum foil tubes, files spilling over metal desks, walls covered in formulas. Even the once genteel sun porch is now a library stacked floor to ceiling with research papers and books. Pincus follows the familiar smell of rabbit dung down the back stairs to the basement. There, he finds one of his top researchers, M.C. Chang, bent over a microscope.
Chang, there you are. I've been looking all over for you. Ah, Dr. Pincus, I've been going over the latest results, and they're not good. I mean, look at these slides. Clearly, the sperm cells are compromised.
Yes, I know. But put that aside for a moment. We have a much more exciting project.
Chang cocks an eyebrow. The Chinese-born biologist hasn't been in the U.S. long, but already he's learned when to be suspicious of Pincus's projects.
I had hoped to complete this experiment first.
I understand, but just listen. We may be able to kill two birds with one stone.
Your American idioms are so strange. Why do you want to kill two birds?
I met Margaret Sanger last night. You know, the birth control advocate? Anyway, she's hired us to develop a contraceptive for women, and she wants us to deliver it in pill form.
Pill form?
Well, this is highly unusual.
Yes, highly.
And you believe it can be done?
How?
Progesterone.
You're referring to the 1937 study?
Yes.
The 1937 study in question have been conducted by two University of Pennsylvania biologists who reported that by injecting rabbits with a naturally occurring hormone called progesterone, they had actually prevented ovulation in rabbits. It was a groundbreaking discovery that no one had any use for at the time. But, Pincus thought, if he and Chang could produce the perfect combination of progesterone, they might be well on their way to creating a birth control pill for women. The theory was grounded in the biological science of menstruation, which was still relatively new at the time. Between puberty and menopause, most women produce an egg from one of their ovaries every 28 days or so. An unfertilized egg can't implant itself on the wall of the womb, so it's discharged with the lining of the uterus, thus a woman's menstrual cycle. But if fertilized, the egg finds a home in the womb, and gestation begins. It's at this point when progesterone shows up, sending a signal to the ovaries to stop producing eggs for the duration of the pregnancy. Pincus explains all of this to Chang, concluding, "If we can deliver the right amount of progesterone, it would trick a woman's body into thinking it was pregnant, thus shutting down egg production, so she can't get pregnant. It's simple and quite perfect." Gregory Pincus doesn't need any more convincing to take on Margaret Sanger's challenge. And Chang is already furiously scribbling notes on a nearby crumpled piece of paper. As far as Pincus is concerned, there's really just one problem. "You know, Chang, contraceptives are illegal in Massachusetts." "Oh, I'm well aware. But there's funding?" "Well, we didn't exactly go over the details. So we're going to develop an illegal pill to give healthy women so they don't get pregnant, and we don't have a funding commitment."
Pincus grins. "Precisely."
For Pincus, going out on a limb was nothing new. By the time he met Margaret Sanger, he'd been doing it most of his adult life. This would be his biggest risk, that much was certain. And Pincus really did share and appreciate Sanger's desire to help women. But beyond the challenge, what he craved was redemption. His career had certainly started on the right track. The son of Russian Jewish immigrants, Pincus had made better than good. He'd earned a degree in biology at Cornell before heading to Harvard, where he became one of the top young research scientists in his graduate program. Pincus was fascinated with the beginnings of life, so he trained as a specialist in mammal reproduction and threw himself into his research. And by 1934, at the tender age of 31, he had discovered something so revolutionary it was sure to launch him into scientific stardom. Or so he thought. At the annual conference of the prestigious National Academy of Sciences, before an audience of his heroes and his peers, Pincus confidently stood at the podium to announce his latest findings.
"I'm here today to announce that I have managed to fertilize rabbit eggs in a test tube and transplant them successfully into the body of a host rabbit. I was then able to bring the rabbit zygotes to full term. The implications of this discovery are, of course, well, far beyond exciting."
The reception at the conference was tepid at best. At the time, few of Pincus's fellow scientists saw much use for his discovery. More thought the experiments were completely unethical. Creating a life in a petri dish was akin to playing God. Newspapers, including the New York Times, touted him as a figure from a horror movie, Shelley's Victor Frankenstein come to life. Pincus was devastated. In his naivete, he'd expected to be hailed as a visionary, but the world wasn't ready. Soon after, Pincus lost his job at Harvard. They simply couldn't risk their reputation on his outrageous experiments. So Pincus set out on his own. And by 1946, he and a colleague had started their own lab, the Worcester Foundation for Experimental Biology. It was a bold move. Nobody had ever tried to establish a serious lab independent of the academic establishment. But if anyone could do it, it was Pincus. There were two things that Pincus was really good at: science and promoting his work. Without academic funding, Pincus would have to keep the foundation's coffers flowing. But it was a job he was well suited for. Pincus never had a problem asking for anything. Days after the meeting with Sanger, Pincus designed a series of experiments to expand on the 1937 study of progesterone. Problem was, he wasn't sure where to get his hands on enough progesterone to work with. He knew that it had been used in the 1940s by scientists hoping to treat women with gynecological disorders. But natural progesterone was difficult to come by. Extracting it from animals was time-consuming and extremely expensive. In part, the pill was intended to address a socioeconomic issue. So affordability would be key, Unless researchers found a method to produce an effective synthetic version of the hormone, the treatment would be completely impractical. And find it they did, in the most humble of places. The Mexican yam proved to be an excellent source for the cheap mass production of progesterone. It turns out the compounds in the roots of the plant had a molecular structure similar to progesterone. But no one, except for Pincus, had a clue that it could be used for birth control. He and Chang constantly tinkered with different formulas. Within a month, they went through more than 200 mixtures that could prove useful for their pill. Using an eyedropper, Chang would try feeding small amounts of the concoction to the rabbits. Then he'd try injecting it. Still, none of the mixtures nor the administrations ever yielded anything but mixed results. It's a cold night in March at the Worcester lab. Pincus makes his way through the empty halls of the foundation, downstairs to check in with Chang, as he does most evenings. He finds the research scientist dissecting one of the rabbits to confirm whether they've produced eggs. Pincus knows Chang loathes performing this act. Chang, why don't you get someone else to handle that? I know you hate it. I need to feel the experiments through my hands. If we're taking the lives of these creatures to further science, then I won't delegate the responsibility. Would you send someone else in your place to fight a battle? It depends. How's their aim? Chang finally cracks a smile. Later that summer, Pincus is making his normal rounds at the foundation when he hears Chang shout from his lab.
Victory! Victory!
Pincus rushes downstairs.
What is it?
We have it! The pellet! It works!
No pregnancy?
5 months of rabbit fornication and not one fertilization.
A pellet is 10 milligrams of synthetic progesterone. Inserting it under the rabbit's skin has resulted in zero pregnancies in 5 months. Pincus couldn't have asked for better results.
Excellent. It's time. Rats? Rats. For better or worse, rats are more like humans, which is why they've been the subject of countless human research projects. Pincus and Chan immediately start giving the hormone to the lab rats. Then they cage the males and females together. And then they wait.
It's 24 days later. The gestation cycle for a female rat. Pincus is in his office, on the phone, thanking the local bakery for the 2 dozen glazed maple donuts they've sent over for the staff. Chang strolls into the office and straight over to the donuts. His gait is uncharacteristically triumphant. Pincus looks up from his call.
Well?
Chang grabs a donut and takes a giant bite. He takes his time chewing.
Don't you want one? I prefer cigarettes. Go on.
The female rats are not pregnant. Victory. September comes and goes, and they continue administering the synthetic progesterone. The female rats are still not pregnant. Another victory. By October 1951, Pincus has all the evidence he needs to move over to the next phase, human trials. Sanger's dream is closer than ever, but he has a big problem. They're flat out of money. Sanger will need to send an influx of cash pronto.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA.
Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
When Pincus telephones Sanger about the progress they've made, she's over the moon. She promises a check will be forthcoming in the next week. Every day, Pincus rushes to the mailbox, cigarette dangling from his mouth, to go through the mail. On day 7, it arrives. He rips open the envelope with Sanger's familiar cursive and looks at the check. This can't be right. $2,000? He shakes the envelope, but nothing else spills out. He was assuming that Sanger would come through with enough funds to move the project forward. $2,000 would barely get them through a few more weeks. Pincus calls her right away.
Margaret, hello. First off, thank you for the $2,000.
He hesitates. Sanger is nothing if not formidable.
I say this with the utmost respect. The amount is...
ludicrous is the word that comes to mind.
It's prohibitive. We can't continue like this. Please tell me there's more coming.
I'm sorry, Gregory. There's no more money. I have little of my own to give, and my organization is getting cold feet. We're going to have to get creative.
Sanger's influence with the organization she co-founded has been waning for years. Even as an elderly woman, she continued to represent the radical wing of the birth control movement. It was at odds with the measured, slightly more conservative way the new leadership was proceeding. Not to mention that they didn't have as much faith as she did in the idea of the pill or her maverick scientist. Pincus hangs up, no better off than when he dialed. He can't back down now. He's on the verge of an historic breakthrough. He has to come up with a solution. As the founder of an independent research facility, he's no stranger to fundraising. Time and time again, he'd won over the hearts and wallets of the Worcester community. Last year, he'd managed to raise $500 with little more than a barbershop quartet serenading visitors on the front lawn. But he isn't foolish enough to think that funding for a controversial birth control pill could be raised in the same way. Pincus realizes that somewhere down the line, they were going to need a pharmaceutical company to make and market the pill. The sooner one was brought in, he thought, the better its chance of success. And Pincus already had a relationship with one of the biggest drug companies in the country. G.D. Searle Pharmaceutical Company had already funded $500,000 in his foundation projects. One of them had been to synthesize cortisone for arthritis, but another company had found a cheaper and quicker way to get the product made. Searle finally pulled the rest of their funding when none of the other projects Pincus was spearheading resulted in any marketable drugs. But now, Pincus had two reasons to go back to Searle. For one, the company had recently made their own synthetic form of progesterone. Before they realized it would be useful for Pincus's pill, it was being marketed as a treatment for women's painful menstrual cycles. He also thought he could convince them of the value of being first to the market with an oral contraceptive. So what if nobody else was developing one? Pincus would argue that the times were changing. Someone was going to be the first, and that someone, he surmised, stood to make millions. Surely Searle would want to be a part of that. The pitch was far too important to deliver over the phone. So Pincus contacted the company and arranged for a face-to-face meeting. He gathered his research materials and traveled to their corporate headquarters in Skokie, Illinois, to make the pitch in person. It's a rainy day in the late fall of 1951. In the northern Chicago suburb of Skokie, Dr. Gregory Pincus is standing outside of his motel, smoking a cigarette while he waits for his ride. It's hard to believe that less than a year has passed since he met Margaret Sanger at a cocktail party in Manhattan. Now he's on the precipice of a monumental discovery. A shiny 1951 forest green Buick Roadmaster pulls up in front of his motel. Pincus throws his briefcase on the trunk and slides into the passenger seat. Behind the wheel is the head of the Searle Pharmaceuticals Research Department, Dr. Albert Raymond.
Nice ride, Albert. It gets me from point A to point B.
The stern-faced Raymond is never one for light banter. He carefully steers the Buick down Skokie Boulevard.
It's great to see you, Albert. I've got a lot of exciting research to share from my latest project. Or wait till I lay it all out for you. We're on the verge of something huge. We just need an infusion of cash to keep it going. Frankly, Gregory, you've got a hell of a lot of nerve asking us for anything. You don't have a great track record with Searle. Oh, just a minute, Albert. I can't help it if our past experiments were beat to the finish line by, you know, another company. We came close. Close isn't good enough, considering we invested $500,000.
Finkus lights up a Viceroy and takes a long drag. This wasn't going as he planned.
Would you mind rolling down the window, please? It's different this time. We're onto something big. It's bigger than anything I've worked on in my entire career. What is it exactly?
He'll wait to get into the minutiae once they arrive at the Searle headquarters. In the meantime, Pincus pitches the entire crazy idea, along with their latest findings on progesterone. By the time he finishes, Raymond's head is practically spinning.
You're talking about taking healthy women and giving them pills to stop their ovulation? And on top of that, you want to do human trials? It's an absurd notion, and no one in their right mind will go for it. Surely there's someone at Searle who'd be interested. Think about the future profits.
Let me be blunt. I took this meeting as a courtesy to you. But there's nothing I can do to convince the board, nor do I want to convince them. It's a no. It's a firm no.
Pincus returns to Worcester, empty-handed and devastated, having never even made it to the boardroom of Searle. He attempts one final plea in a letter to Raymond, but it doesn't work. Pincus is back to square one, with barely enough money to make it through the holidays. They've come too close to not succeed. The birth control pill will be revolutionary and historic. He knows he can make it happen. But there will be no world-changing pill without money. A lot more money than the meager amount Margaret Sanger was so far able to scrape together. He didn't know what he would tell the feisty Sanger if they couldn't proceed. Pincus would have to find other funding as soon as possible, or the whole project would be dead in the water just as it was getting started. On the next episode of American Innovations, a guardian angel swoops in to provide money and becomes an important ally. And as Pincus readies for human trials, he discovers test subjects are not as easy to find as rats and rabbits. But the maverick scientist is determined to move forward, even if it means going outside the law. I hope you enjoyed this episode of American Innovations. If you did, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One, and every major listening app, as well as at Wondery.com. If you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast. You'll find the episode notes, including some details you might have missed. You'll also find some offers from our sponsors. Please support our show by supporting them. And thank you. American Innovations is hosted by me, Stephen Johnson. For more information on my books about science and innovation, including How We Got to Now, you can visit my website, www.stephenberlinjohnson.com. Sound design on this episode is by Spoke Media. This episode was written by Elizabeth Cosen, with editing by Loredana Palavoda. Our producer is Emma Cortland. Executive produced by Marshall Louie and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.